Well, good morning. We're looking at toward truly comprehensive care, how recent changes in federal health policy promote integrated care. And this is sponsored by the mental health section. My name is Laurie Flynn. I'm from the Columbia University Teen Screen Program in New York. And I will introduce the rest of our panelists. Our first presenter is Andrew Sperling, Bruce Leslie, who is shown on your program, who is the president of First Focus, was unfortunately called to Texas with a family medical emergency. So we're very pleased to have Andrew Sperling stepping up and taking over the first talk. Andrew is the director of federal legislative affairs for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. I will give the second talk. And I've just introduced myself. The only other thing perhaps to know is that before I went to Columbia 10 years ago, I spent 16 years as the National Executive Director at NAMI here in Washington. The speaker following me will be Catherine Finley. Catherine Finley had a number of years, more than a decade of work on Capitol Hill, working most recently for former Senator Gordon Smith. She was very active in the passage of the Garrett Lee Smith Act. She is now, after serving as well with Senator DeWine, former Senator DeWine of Ohio, and Senator Olympia Snowe, she is now a principal at Thorn Run Partners, a consulting group here in D.C. And after Catherine speaks, we will hear from David Shern. Is that correct? I think we will hear from David Shern. I hope I have the order right. We've had several substitutions. David Shern is a former chair of this section, and David Shern is currently the CEO and president of the National Association Mental Health America. Prior to coming to Mental Health America 5 years ago, David spent nearly 10 years as dean of the Louis Delapart Institute at the University of South Florida. And prior to that, he worked in public health and public mental health in Colorado and New York State. And then our final speaker will be Dena Chisholm. Mm-hmm. And Dena Chisholm is standing in for Kelly Kelleher. Dena is an associate professor of pediatrics and public health at The Ohio State University. And she is a principal investigator and works very closely with Dr. Kelleher at the Center for Innovation in Pediatric Practice at the Research Institute at Nationwide Hospital in Columbus. So we have an array of backgrounds and talents here to present a variety of facets, several different ways to look at how recent developments in federal policy are moving us towards truly comprehensive care. So now let me turn this over to Andrew Sperling.
Thank you, Lori. It's great to be here with Lori. I should note, she mentioned 16 years at NAMI, where I work, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Hopefully some of you know NAMI. It's a very large organization. We have more than 1,100 affiliates all over the country. We're largely family members and people living with mental illness. And that growth that took NAMI from a very small, unstaffed organization to where it is today was almost entirely through the leadership of Lori and her 16 years at NAMI. And it's a legacy that lives on and continues to make NAMI a strong organization. So everyone at NAMI still remembers fondly her years as executive director, and our strength today is largely due to her leadership. I understand from the slide I have to disclose that I have no relationships, and that's a dangerous thing for a Washington lobbyist to say, but that's part of the disclosures, because in lobbying and policy in Washington, it's all about relationships and developing relationships over time, which we work very hard to do, but I understand that involves relationships with corporate entities, not our relationships with leaders in Congress and in the administration that we have to rely on to try and push our agenda forward. Let me just first talk a little bit about prevalence, and those of you, hopefully, you should know all this if you don't, but let me just remind you in terms of the prevalence of mental illness in this country. Nearly one in four adults suffer from a diagnosable disorder in a given year. We know that approximately 11% of our nation's youth suffer from a mental illness that can cause significant functional impairment in their daily lives. Mental disorders are the leading cause of disability for Americans aged 15 to 44. And then a statistic that we've been very focused on at NAMI over the last few years, and that is the medical comorbidities associated with a serious disorder such as schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and these are medical disorders we're talking about, diabetes, heart disease, COPD, asthma, et cetera, account for enormous early mortality. And the statistic we've been using, which has been a little bit discredited, about 25 years of lost life expectancy, not because of the prevalence, but largely because of what the denominator we're comparing it to. But the shocking statistic that we use over and over again to sort of grab people by the lapels on this, and that is that an adult living with schizophrenia or bipolar disorder in this country today has a life expectancy just below an adult in Bangladesh. Okay? So for any measured population, this is a population for which the pathologies associated with high consumption of tobacco, poor diet, sedentary lifestyle, poor access to primary care, side effects of medication, this is the sickest population of any measured population in this country, and it is a shocking statistic and something that we need to move more aggressively on as a country, both in terms of public health, research, a multifaceted agenda. We're going to hear a lot more about that later this morning. And we know that there's an artificial separation between mental health and physical health, and that's quite frankly responsible for those shocking statistics about early mortality for people with serious mental illness. Now, we've made enormous progress in recent years. We've had a number of laws passed. I'm going to go through these very, very quickly to set up some of the presentations you'll hear later. But let me just talk about a couple of these. Number one, the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act, the so-called Wellstone-Domenici Law that NAMI and MHA, where David works, spent nearly 20 years trying to get passed. I'm going to go a little bit of detail about that in a minute. In 2009, that was passed in 2008. In 2009, we had the reauthorization of the Children's Health Insurance Program, the CHIPRA legislation. We made some progress there. Health Information Technology in 2009, the HITECH Act that passed, and the nearly $20 billion investment that was made in ARRA and the Recovery Act for pushing us along on an electronic medical records and health information technology. Some problems there that I'll talk about in a minute, but that was an important step forward. And then largest of all, of course, the Affordable Care Act from 2010 and the challenges we faced there, but some real opportunities. So let me go through these very, very quickly just so you understand. Hopefully some of you are familiar with the parity law. We've had 43 of these state laws that have passed in recent decades, but the biggest one we got was the 2008 law at the federal level, and what was big about that was not that it was so much better than all the state laws that were out there, but some of you that work in group health plans or know that the largest group cohort of people participating in group health plans are through the federal ERISA law, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, whereby group health plans employers can self-insure under this federal ERISA law and then thereby exempt themselves from state regulation. So we can pass all the great state laws we want, but until we got that standard in ERISA, we really weren't eradicating discriminatory coverage for the large majority of people who have employer-covered health care. Just to remind you some of the details of this law, it does not require coverage of mental health or substance abuse benefits. It's a fairly simple coverage condition. It's not a mandate. It simply says, if you offer coverage for mental health and substance abuse, you have to do it on the same terms and conditions. You can't impose durational limits on inpatient care or outpatient visits. You can't have separate higher deductibles. You have to have equal cost sharing. You have to have out-of-pocket limits that are equal. But below that requirement, quite frankly, the law gets a little complicated, and we're still working on some of the big challenges related to implementation in terms of what we call non-quantitative treatment limits. So it's not a quantitative limit in terms of a cap on inpatient days or outpatient visits, but you have group health plans that manage benefits for mental health and substance abuse in a completely different way than they do for medical surgical, having separate management techniques, separate definitions of medical necessity, definitions of medical necessity that are applied in a different way. In NAMI's view, those are, in fact, the interim final regulations that were published in 2010, we believe those are clear violations of both the letter and the spirit of the law, and we're working hard to get that fully implemented, and we're not fully there yet. But we did have strong regulations. It's more clearly defined what the definition of parity was, which in the law, which is really no more restrictive than the predominant benefit. We don't want plans essentially narrowing the scope of, not imposing numerical limits, but narrowing the scope of mental health and substance abuse benefits at variance with what they're doing on the medical surgical side. Again, we think, and the regulations are fairly clear, that those are not allowed. But we've also done some things to, quite frankly, extend the scope of the parity law. And we certainly did that with the SCHIP legislation, the reauthorization of the SCHIP program. We also were able to achieve that in the Affordable Care Act, and I'll talk about that in more detail in just a minute. Health information technology, I'll briefly mention. So hopefully your agencies are working hard on this, on electronic medical records, and moving forward aggressively on this. As you know, there was nearly $20 billion put in the recovery legislation from back in 2009, but unfortunately the definition of providers that were eligible, particularly on the Medicare side, those of you who are familiar with R, you know that there's essentially there were carrots and sticks. There were incentives and higher reimbursement rates for providers that met that definition of the law of meaningful use. Okay, those are the key words. You have to reach a standard of meaningful use of health information technology in order to access those bonus payments and infrastructure grants and other financial incentives. And then eventually in 2015, I believe, the stick's going to come. In other words, you'll be penalized on reimbursement if you haven't met that meaningful use standard. Unfortunately, the definition in the statute of those community-based providers, so a lot of community health centers were able to access money, a lot of other types of clinics. Unfortunately, in our specialty mental health sector, community mental health centers and other community-based providers largely were ineligible for that. The physicians they employed could get some of that money. It's sort of complicated on how that worked out. And so that required us to go back to Congress, and Senator Sheldon Whitehouse from Rhode Island, who's a big supporter of ours, has introduced legislation to try and fix that oversight in the law so that, that specialty mental health providers were able to access funds under the HITECH Act. And I'll only just turn and briefly talk about the Affordable Care Act. It's a big, big statute, and there's a lot in there, and I could go on and on for a long time about various provisions. I just want to highlight a few that really are going to make a tremendous difference for people with mental illness. And probably the biggest is the expansion of Medicaid eligibility up to 133% of the federal poverty level. In order for a child or an adult living with a mental illness under current law, previous Medicaid law, to qualify for Medicaid, they had to meet one of the categorical definitions. And the one that most people were able to reach was being eligible for SSI, Supplemental Security Income. But that's a very, very high bar to reach. Okay, it means that you're essentially totally disabled, that you're so impaired that you can't work in any job in the American economy at substantial gainful activity. Okay, it's a very high bar to reach. And we know that there are many people with mental illness that aren't able to reach that bar. Now, not only do they have to reach that impairment level, they have to impoverish themselves. Essentially have no assets and no income. Okay? That means, quite frankly, it's very, very difficult to reach. And once they reach that, it's very difficult to ever get off the rolls and have a more productive, full life of recovery in the community. That's all going to change with the Affordable Care Act when the eligibility standard for Medicaid becomes 133% of the federal poverty level with no asset test. So you're not going to have to go to a state agency and demonstrate that you're so completely, totally disabled that you can't work. Okay? And that so there's a whole cadre, huge cohort of single adults with mental illness that are going to be able to get eligible for SSI. It's actually 138% because there's a 5% income disregard. That's a very, very big and very, very important change for us. And we have to make sure that the benefits those individuals get when they get onto Medicaid meet their very complex, multifaceted needs, not just their psychiatric treatment. And as important as that is, it's also getting access to coordinated care for co-occurring medical disorders and medical conditions. As we talked about, addressing this early mortality that's, quite frankly, tragic and inexcusable. So there's some real opportunities to promote integrated care, both in Medicaid, the expanded Medicaid, and then other areas beyond Medicaid in terms of the exchanges and people that are above 133% of the federal poverty level that will be coming into coverage through those areas. So we're working very, very hard on that. We have, for example, an authority in the law for co-location of primary care and specialty mental health settings, which is a model NAMI thinks has enormous promise to co-locate primary care nurses and primary care doctors in specialty mental health settings. We also have the opportunity to do the reverse, to expand the capacity of mental health treatment and mental health screening and early intervention in primary care settings. We know that the earlier we catch these disorders, the more successful the outcomes. I think David's hopefully going to talk a little bit about models that we know work to do that. I think Lori is too, about screening and early intervention to catch, because we know the science tells us that the earlier we catch these disorders, the more successful we are in achieving outcomes. There's a whole number of authorities related in Medicaid for chronic care delivery, what we call medical homes. Many of you in this room probably know more about medical homes than I do, but what we know is that coordinated care is sorely needed for this population. And there's a new authority in the law under the Affordable Care Act to try and do patient-centered medical homes to do better care coordination, which is sorely needed for this population. But we have to take advantage of these opportunities to move to truly integrated care. That's where the science tells us we're going to get successful recovery-based, recovery-oriented outcomes to try and deal not just with untreated mental illness, which is there are enormous public health burdens associated with that, but also dealing with, quite frankly, coordinated care between mental health and primary care. But our job isn't done, and let me close on some areas where we quite frankly need to do a lot more work. Let me first mention on parity. We've got terrific interim final regulations, but quite frankly, we have a growing body of evidence through our partners, MHA and NAMI and a number of other organizations. We have found hundreds of instances of what we believe is non-compliance with the law. We have health plans that are, in our view, in a fairly brazen way, ignoring key provisions in the interim final regulations, particularly related to non-quantitative treatment limits. We have health plans in a number of states that have very aggressively moved in and imposed blanket policies of prior authorization and using provisions to actually push providers out of their health plans. We believe that's a fairly blatant violation of the law, and we've got a lot of work to do with the Department of Labor and the Department of Health and Human Services to try and get these interim final rules enforced in a more aggressive way. On the High Tech Act, I mentioned, I'm almost done. We've got Senator Whitehouse's legislation to try and address some of the inequities in the law to allow community-based mental health providers to take advantage of funds and move more aggressively toward electronic health records. We know we're going to fail at better integration of mental health and primary care without a functioning system of electronic medical records to allow primary care physicians and specialty medical care physicians to work more closely with mental health providers. And electronic medical records have to be a part of that. And finally, on the Affordable Care Act, as you know, a lot of challenges there relative to implementation. Just yesterday, we had the deadline for comments on the exchanges. These are the state-based models that are largely going to be responsible for expanding care to the uninsured above that new Medicaid expansion level of 133%. Many organizations, hopefully, here today, we submitted comments on ways we believe the exchanges can be strengthened to make sure that this works. And then we also have, just in the last few 2 weeks ago, the Institute of Medicine released recommendations to Secretary Sebelius for the essential benefits package. One of the things about the exchanges, and hopefully you know this, I see heads nodding, I'm telling you something you probably already know, but there's all of the plans offered to the exchanges have to meet a minimum standard defined in federal law as the essential health benefits package in order to be a qualified health plan. Now, the good news there is that mental health and substance abuse are required as one of the 10 broad categories of benefits that have to be in the essential benefits package. That's a good thing, okay? The challenge is that's all the statute said, and the statute told the secretary to go out and contract with the Institute of Medicine to get recommendations on how we define each of those 10 categories, not just initially, but how they're updated over time. And there we think, the Institute of Medicine, at least in NAMI's view, probably fell a little short. They didn't provide a lot of definition of those 10 categories, but then more importantly, they actually went and told the secretary, we recommend that you, in terms of the value of that essential health benefits package, that we think you should tag it to, you should relate it to, you should benchmark it to the typical employer plan in, get this, the small employer market. Okay? Now, why is that of concern to NAMI? The reason it's of concern to NAMI is if you look into that small group market, what you're going to find in terms of mental health benefits is a fairly sparse benefit package. You're going to find a market that is largely exempt from state parity laws, and at least in terms of the 50 and under group health plan market, is exempt from that Wellstone Domenici parity law, which means you may find in that typical small employer market plans that are still imposing caps on inpatient days, limits on outpatient benefits, separate deductibles for mental health that are two or three times the size of the deductible on the medical surgical side, okay? And you're going to find exclusion of benefits, okay? Particularly some of the intensive supports that maybe for like children and adolescents that you see in typical small employer plans. So this is of concern to NAMI. We submitted comments on the IOM report to the secretary. So this is an area we need to be watching closely because these are just recommendations to the secretary, and we're going to see, no one knows exactly when, someone thinks late this year, maybe early into next year, some regulations, some draft regulations from HHS more clearly defining what this essential benefits package is. But the essential benefits package is absolutely critical because that is the standard that's going to operate in these exchanges. I'm probably way over my time, aren't I?
You're good.
Thank you.